Professor Ascher, Brooklyn College, New York. Pavel Axelrod und die Pogrome in Russland, dann die 1980er Jahre, im 19. Jahrhundert.
Anyone generally acquainted with Pavel Borisovich Axelrod's career as a revolutionary would hardly suspect that he had ever been interested in specifically Jewish questions. Although he had been born into a pious Jewish family and in his early 20s had thought of dedicating himself to Jewish enlightenment and emancipation, in 1872 he experienced a spiritual crisis during which he lost interest in Jewish affairs. He had already had doubts about the veracity of the sacred books of the Jewish religion, but now he came also to doubt the existence of God. By chance, he came across Herbert Spencer's Basic Principles, which he read, as he put it, with a kind of aesthetic delight and which converted him to agnosticism. At the same time, he read LaSalle, whose call for economic, social, and political equality for all mankind so fired his imagination that the problems of the Jews now appeared insignificant. Persuaded that the term proletariat, as used by LaSalle, referred to everyone oppressed by the rich and privileged, he concluded that once this broad class was liberated, the Jewish question would automatically be solved. Quote, "And I decided," he wrote, "to devote myself to work for the liberation of all the poor and oppressed of Russia." During his next 5.5 decades as a revolutionary, first as a Bakuninist and member of Charlie Peridiel, and later, from 1883 until his death in 1928 as a Marxist, Axelrod never joined a revolutionary organization and never dealt extensively with Jewish matters in his published writings. A close examination of his life and career reveals, however, that his abandonment of interest in Jewish affairs in 1872 was not nearly as final as he may have planned. Events in Russia and elsewhere were to show that before the goal of universal equality could be attained, much would happen to prompt a Jewish revolutionary to concern himself with the plight of his co-religionists. In fact, as my research into Axelrod's career deepened, I realized that I could not restrict this paper to a discussion of his role during the pogroms of the early 1880s. On at least three other occasions, he commented on Jews on issues of special significance in Jewish history, and each time his reactions and opinions were rather different from what they were earlier. With the passage of the years, his sympathy for Jews suffering from persecution seemed to intensify, and by 1917, his confidence in the ability of the general revolutionary movement to solve the Jewish problem had clearly been shaken. I therefore decided to broaden the scope of this paper somewhat and treat Axelrod's changing attitude toward what is usually referred to as the Jewish question. The pogroms of the 1880s were a turning point for many Jewish revolutionaries in Russia, not so much because of the unprecedented intensity and duration of the anti-Jewish disorders, but because substantial numbers among the enlightened and progressive elements of society were indifferent to them or even approved of them. At least during the early stages of the attacks, the government of Alexander III opposed them, while ironically, a significant number of revolutionaries welcomed them. Both believed that the pogroms might set off the general social revolution. While provincial governors were ordered to suppress the violence and protect the Jews, all the major revolutionary papers, except one, carried articles hailing the pogroms as the first sign that the masses were bestirring themselves. Thus, one Narodovolets reporting on the disorders in Odessa assured his readers that the slogan of the pogromshtchiki was, and I quote, "Let us finish off the Jews, and then we will revolt against the Russians," end of quote. He warned the revolutionary movement not to stand aside but to strive to lead the forces of rebellion. A Charlie Peredelitz explained that the peasants had turned against the Jews first only because they considered exploitation by them more odious than that by their own countrymen. In yet another article, the authority of Taine, the French historian, was invoked to show that all popular upheavals must begin with an attack upon the Jews. According to the author, Taine had pointed out that the great French Revolution had begun in this way. This, and I quote, continued the Narodov Volyets, is the Jews' unfortunate fate, which evidently cannot be avoided, end of quote. Moreover, according to another revolutionary leaflet, the Jews were making things worse by appealing for help to the authorities. Such appeals only served to sharpen the general hostility to them. The most extreme statement was made, of course, by the Executive Committee of Narodnaya Volya on August 30th, 1881, in the Ukraine, who in a proclamation encouraged the people to smite the Jews. The man who apparently inspired the document, G. Romanenko, was undoubtedly an anti-Semite. But most of the other revolutionaries welcoming the pogroms were not. They were simply so convinced of the revolutionary potential of the peasants and so desperate to see it manifest itself that they were prepared to clutch at straws. Moreover, cognizant of the failure in the early 1870s, 1874 to be precise, of the Go to the People movement to impose its program upon the peasants, these revolutionaries now argued in favor of agitating on the basis of the peasants' interests and demands. Many Jewish radicals, thoroughly dismayed and disillusioned by this turn of events, left Russia and began to reappraise their political commitments. Several settled in Zurich, where Axelrod also lived, and formed a circle to study the Jewish question in Russia. One of the more active members of the group was Gregory Gurevich, who had been a student and close friend of Axelrod in Mogilev during the 1860s. Since 1880, Gurevich had been living with the Axelrods and frequently discussed political issues with his host, many of whose views he shared. But unlike Axelrod, Gurevich had never severed his ties with Jewish politics and was among the first to advocate agitation among Jewish workers in Yiddish. At a social gathering one evening, probably early in 1882, Gurevich reproached Axelrod, then the most prominent Jewish revolutionary, for not speaking up against the pogroms. Axelrod defended himself by saying that he lacked sufficient information about the recent events in Russia to write about them. Now I quote, "I objected to this," Gurevich relates, "by saying that for a declaration of one's attitude towards the outrageous pogroms, it was not necessary to engage in scholarly research or to be acquainted with the literature on the question," end of quote. All that was necessary, as far as Gurevich was concerned, was for Axelrod to register a protest. But for Axelrod, the matter was not quite as simple. And his plea of ignorance was not the entire story. For he had already thought about the pogroms, and his assessment had not been as radically different from that of the revolutionaries quoted above as Gurevich seems to have supposed. In an article published in Volnoye Slovo on December 13, 1881, Axelrod argued that had the organized socialist groups expended sufficient effort, the anti-Jewish disorders could have constituted, and I quote, "the beginning of a socialist class movement in the name of land and freedom for the laboring masses. It was only necessary, in Kiev, for example," Axelrod continued, "to direct the crowd to the quarter of the Jewish capitalists, to the banks, where the capital of the upper classes of all nationalities is concentrated. Of course, if the disorder had received this sort of direction, the further course of the movement would inevitably have been such as to lead the rebellious masses into direct clashes with the wealthy elements in general and with a natural ally, the government," end of quote. But to the shame of the socialists, Axelrod held, they had permitted the disorders to develop into a general campaign against an entire nation, during which tens of thousands of proletarians and small shopkeepers had been ruined. In Axelrod's view then, the pogroms had degenerated into senseless rioting, only because the socialists had botched a fine opportunity to bring about the long-awaited social upheaval. He could not conceive of the possibility that in his fury the peasant might be inspired as much by religious prejudice as by revolutionary idealism. It must be remembered that although he had already come under the influence of Marxist ideas, he was still a Bakuninist and a Chornyperogelitz. His faith in the revolutionary activism of the peasantry was far from fully undermined. He still believed that a rebellion, no matter what its immediate cause or aim, might be the spark to set off the revolution for which he yearned. But the continued pressure of the Jewish colony in Zurich, coupled with letters from Jewish intelligentsia in Russia telling of the anti-Semitism they were encountering and of their disillusionment with the revolutionary movement, had their impact on Axelrod. In February 1882, he discussed with Georgi Plekhanov, Peter Lavrov, Leo Deitch, and Sergei Stepniak, all friends and political colleagues, the advisability of putting out a brochure in protest against the pogroms and against their favorable reception by the revolutionary press. They all agreed that such a brochure would be desirable and thought that a Gentile among them should write it. But Plekhanov was too busy with other work, and neither Lavrov nor Stepniak felt equipped to write on the subject. Vexed that his colleagues seemed to consider the question of the pogroms less important than others, Axelrod decided to write the brochure himself in the hope that it would be published by the Executive Committee of Narodnaya Volya. Although requested to do so, the committee apparently was not interested. Plekhanov then promised to put out the brochure after it had been approved by him and his comrades in the name of a group of socialist revolutionaries. It was to be signed by Lavrov, Plekhanov, Zasulich, Stepniak, Deitch, and Axelrod so as to demonstrate that several eminent socialists, not merely one man, were appalled by the events in Russia. Axelrod did not complete the manuscript, and the draft that has remained is sketchy and somewhat disjointed. Sometimes it is difficult to determine precisely what he had in mind, because he simply mentioned several of his more important points without elaborating them. Still, the general trend of his thought emerges with sufficient clarity to be discussed. Axelrod addressed himself primarily to Jewish radicals in an effort to clarify their future political tasks. He said he understood and sympathized with their despair at discovering that their attempts to assimilate themselves into Russian culture and politics had been rebuffed by the, quote, truly disgraceful spectacle, end of quote, of anti-Semitism. He appreciated their being disheartened by the revelation that many Russians still regarded them as members of an alien and despised national group. Nevertheless, he was convinced that the pogroms were not merely the manifestation of deep-seated national and religious prejudice. He contended that their major cause derived from the economic structure of the country and the position occupied by the Jews in that structure. Because of their long history of persecution and exclusion from what he termed productive work, and especially from agriculture, an inordinately large number of Jews served as middlemen, as traders, shopkeepers, and usurers. Most of them were far from wealthy, as he could well recall from his own childhood. In fact, in all but function, many could be classified as proletarians. The peasants, however, looked upon the Jews as parasites, as exploiters, as people who did not earn their livelihood by the sweat of their brows. The Gentile petty bourgeoisie and capitalists despised Jews because they saw in them their fiercest competitors. And many professional people were antagonistic to them because they feared the rivalry of Jews attempting to enter the universities. Quote, in Russia, therefore, Axelrod concluded, the Jews are an economic force that in the struggle for existence and wealth comes into conflict with the most varied strata of the population. This explained the solidarity of the Gentile population in its hostility against Jews. And the government, as well as the Gentile capitalists, was prepared to exploit the hostility in order to provide an outlet for the widespread popular unrest. Axelrod's analysis, which has been refined and modified, but not discarded by recent historians of the pogroms, implied that the Jewish problem in Russia was far more complicated than he had previously thought. For if anti-Semitic feelings were not simply a prejudice of misguided individuals, but deeply ingrained in all social strata of Russia, could the Jewish intelligentsia abandon their people and dedicate themselves wholly to the general revolutionary cause? Were not the Jews suffering from a special form of oppression which might not be touched by the revolutionary program then being advocated? Axelrod dealt with this problem in the last part of his article. Unfortunately, the sketchiest section of the manuscript. He toyed with several possibilities, but did not work any of them out in detail. While working on the manuscript, Axelrod was in touch both with the Jewish colony in Zurich and his political colleagues, and one senses that he was laboring under conflicting pressures and inner uncertainties. He now conceded that it was legitimate for Jewish socialists to concern themselves primarily with the plight of the Jewish lower classes, though not for the purpose of achieving a, quote, national renaissance of Judaism, end of quote, or the establishment of a Jewish state. Several times, Axelrod stressed that this interest in strictly Jewish affairs must go no further than concern for the well-being of poor Jews. But in one place, he said that as soon as the persecution of his co-religionists had ended, quote, Jewish socialists must be entirely indifferent to the fate of their own capitalists, end of quote, who, he asserted, had shown far more interest in their pocketbooks than in the Jewish nation during the disorders. The implication here, but it is no more than an implication, is that until the disappearance of religious animosities, Jewish socialists should concern themselves with the persecution of all Jews, regardless of class. For Axelrod, the most radical and desirable solution of the Jewish question required a twofold development. First, the conversion of the Jewish masses into a genuine proletariat engaged in physical labor. Second, the fusion or amalgamation of them with the, quote, corresponding strata of the native population, end of quote. Here, Axelrod was extremely vague. He used the word slyanya, but did not define it. From the context, it would appear that at the very least, he had in mind that Jews should adopt the Russian language, immerse themselves in Russian culture, live among non-Jews, and join non-sectarian political organizations. Axelrod conceded that it would be difficult to realize the two goals. Even if external circumstances were favorable, by which he probably meant a cessation of anti-Semitic outbursts and legislation, and the Jewish masses made every effort to take up productive work, it would take at least 10 to 15 years for a new generation of Jewish laborers to emerge. Moreover, the Jewish masses in Russia had attained a higher intellectual and political niveau than their Gentile counterpart, and this ruled out any the possibility of an immediate amalgamation. It would be feasible only after further reforms had raised the intellectual and political sophistication of the Russian lower classes. Ultimately, Axelrod believed that the solutions he was proposing could be achieved only if the autocratic regime was replaced by political institutions allowing the people a maximum of freedom and participation in government. The Jews would then be granted the right to settle in any part of the empire, and the necessary reforms would be effected. Here one can detect the growing influence on Axelrod of Marxism, which, at least as interpreted by its Russian advocates at this time, stressed the necessity of transforming Russia into a bourgeois country. In the meantime, Jewish socialists ought to collaborate with Gentile socialists in educating cadres of dedicated revolutionaries within the Jewish community and in explaining the main causes of the pogroms to the Jews. And they should strive to make the Jewish masses aware that they have much more in common with lower class Christians than with wealthy Jews. Simultaneously, Christian socialists ought to campaign against wholesale attacks on the Jewish community. In the event of further pogroms, they should direct the crowd, as Axelrod had previously suggested, quote, if not against the exploiters in general, then against the rich Jewish quarter only, and primarily against such wealthy people as Brodsky, Polakov, Ginsburg, etc. End of quote. While working on the article, Axelrod considered another possibility then being discussed by Gurevich and his friends, that Russian Jews be encouraged to emigrate to Palestine and take up farming. This plan should not be confused with Herzl's subsequent program, for the aim was not to establish a Jewish state, but simply to provide an escape from persecution. Axelrod consulted the geographer and Bakuninist K. E. Reclus, who found the proposal impracticable. He admitted that the Upper Galilee could be cultivated, but only after considerable irrigation. In addition, most of the land was in private hands, and the Russian consul there, who was very influential, would do his utmost to prevent its being sold to Jews for fear that they would clash with the sizable Russian colony. Reclus therefore feared that Jewish settlers in Palestine would once again become traders and exploit the local population. Leo Deitch also urged Axelrod to give up the Palestinian project on the ground that socialists should not advocate measures that would in any way recognize the Jews as a separate national group. Deitch predicted that in Palestine the Jews would only, quote, stagnate in their own prejudice, end of quote. If emigration was to be encouraged, then it should be to America, where the Jews would be able to amalgamate with the local population. These arguments apparently persuaded Axelrod, for he did not mention the Palestinian project in his manuscript. In tone and content, Axelrod's article was extraordinarily moderate. Indeed, it was not so much a protest against the pogroms as an attempt to understand them and to chart a course of action for Jewish radicals. The proposals in it implied only a temporary deviation from the program to which he had previously subscribed. Nevertheless, his colleagues were beginning to have second thoughts about the advisability of publishing his opinions. On April 14, 1882, Lavrov, who cannot be accused of harboring anti-Semitic prejudice, wrote Axelrod that it was tactically unwise for a Russian Revolutionary Party publicly to oppose the anti-Jewish outbreaks. Quote, theoretically, said Lavrov, it is very easy to solve the Jewish question on paper, but in view of the popular passions and the need for Russian socialists to have the people on their side whenever possible, it becomes an entirely different matter. End of quote. In a postscript to the letter, Deitch voiced unqualified agreement with Lavrov, though he confessed to being pained at having to take such a stand. He explained that the revolutionary movement confronted a dilemma which was not of its own making and which it could handle in no other way. And he added, I quote, I shall always remain a member of the Russian revolutionary movement and will not separate myself from it even for one day, end of quote. Despite the obvious cogency of this argument for a man who 10 years earlier had decided that he could contribute most to solving the Jewish question by working for the triumph of the Russian socialist movement, Axelrod at first persisted in his intention to publish the article. Conviction aside, he feared that the Jewish colony would come to feel that the Cherny Perdyeltsy had promised to speak up without really intending to do so. If his colleagues could not or would not sign the article, then he would publish it under his name alone. He reminded his friends that in the German Social Democratic Party, the demand for unity did not prevent an individual from expressing his personal views. Deitch, speaking for the group, countered that the Cherny Perdyeltsy, now close to an open espousal of Marxism, were operating under extremely difficult conditions. They were few in number, and if they were to accomplish anything, they would have to be, quote, firmly united and act in complete solidarity, end of quote. Their cause would be harmed if it came to light that one person had views different from the others on the Jewish question. We are all very sorry, he wrote Axelrod on May 26, 1882, that you persist in your decision with respect to the Jewish brochure, end of quote. He indicated that the group was still willing to publish it and left the final decision up to Axelrod. This pressure proved to be too much. not the type of person who could easily strike out on his own in defiance of his colleagues, Axelrod was probably also held back by his inability to clarify his attitude towards the pogroms. He had serious doubts about the viability of his solution of the Jewish question, but he was far from having found an acceptable alternative. As a consequence, he left the manuscript unfinished in his drawer. There's evidence to suggest that he later came to have misgivings about his silence in 1882. Axelrod seems to have successfully kept the Jewish question in the back of his mind until the unfolding of another event of major significance in Jewish history, the Dreyfus Affair. This time, he was far more deeply moved and less restrained than he had been in 1882. Early in 1898, he wrote Plekhanov that he could concentrate on nothing but the newspaper reports from France, which absorbed his, quote, head, heart, and entire being, end of quote. To him, the developments in France indicated no less than the, quote, moral and political degradation of a whole nation and the manifestation of the atrophy of the elemental sense of justice and of wild, tribal, shameful chauvinism, end of quote. He was particularly stunned by the indifference of the French labor movement to the trial of Émile Zola. Its failure to demonstrate against the distressing events convinced him that one-half to four-fifths of the French working class were, quote, degenerate fools and cretins, end of quote. And this, he added, was the result of four revolutions. A gentle and undemonstrative person, Axelrod rarely expressed himself with such passion. He did so only when he felt a fundamental political and moral question was at stake. Axelrod suggested to Plekhanov that the Russian colonies in Zurich and Geneva write Zola a letter of sympathy and support in order morally to reward him for the, quote, loathsome attitude towards him of his countrymen, end of quote. At first, Plekhanov did not respond to the suggestion, nor did he mention the Dreyfus Affair at all. Axelrod, angered, could not believe that his friend viewed the matter with, quote, Olympian indifference. Truly, he wrote him, you must be very absorbed in some kind of work, he remarked sarcastically. Finally, Plekhanov commented on the affair, and his words reveal, perhaps as much as anything, the profound difference in character and outlook between the two founders of the Russian Marxist movement. Plekhanov was personally convinced of Dreyfus's innocence, though he said he was not sure why, but he thought Axelrod was too harsh in his condemnation of the French workers for not wanting to get involved in the, quote, bourgeois affair, end of quote. Plekhanov admitted that the workers' attitude was wrong, and now I quote Plekhanov, an innocent person must be defended even if he is a bourgeois. But if you keep in mind how badly and spitefully the French bourgeoisie has treated the workers, then you yourself will agree that this wrong behavior is pardonable, end of quote. Still, he was willing to send a letter of sympathy to Zola, but his readiness to do so was apparently rather half-hearted, and Axelrod, ever excessively timid, was not prepared to act on his own. Hence, no letter was sent, to Axelrod's deep regret. In 1917, Axelrod publicly acknowledged his doubts about the solution of the Jewish question to which he had been committed for 45 years. On November 25th of that year, the Jewish Press Bureau in Stockholm asked several leading socialists to comment on the impending peace and the Jewish question, and I found a complete version of Axelrod's statement at the International Institute for Social History in Amsterdam. He no longer hesitated strongly to condemn anti-Semitism, nor did he show any reluctance to having his views publicized. Most interesting, he assigned to the international proletariat, he no doubt had in mind a resurrected international, the task of intervening with the greatest possible vigor in behalf of Jews wherever they were persecuted, regardless of the depth of popular prejudices. He singled out Poland, Galicia, and Romania as areas where such action would be appropriate. Not only must Jews be granted full rights of citizenship, they must also be accorded the right of national self-determination and of, quote, national autonomy on a personal basis. Here, Axelrod did not Axelrod did not elaborate on the latter point, but it is clear that he had abandoned his idea of amalgamation and his long-standing opposition to a principal contention of the Bund that the Jews constituted a nation. But the most profound change in his outlook was revealed when he was asked to comment on Zionism. After pleading ignorance on the subject, he acknowledged that there was a conflict within his soul between several points of view. I quote, "When I indulge in the dream of a happy, united humanity, then it appears to me a pity that the Jews exert so much energy in colonizing Palestine. But in view of the hard facts of reality, of the pogroms, and of all the various forms of Jewish persecution, there stirs within me sympathy for Palestine, and a wish to see in the realization of the Zionist goal a refuge for that unhappy people. Very often it seems to me that the fate of the poorest nation of the world is to be envied if only it has a place of its own and a certain territory which it can regard as its undisputed historical property." End of quote. In any case, there was no doubt in his mind that the, quote, "concrete demand of the Jewish socialist organization Poel Etzion for unimpeded Jewish colonization of Palestine was absolutely justified." Incidentally, I found only one published account of these remarks in the Menshevik paper Novy Luch, published in Moscow on January 27, 1918. The account is quite detailed and accurate, except for one omission, Axelrod's favorable attitude toward Zionism. All in all, Axelrod wrote and said so little on Jewish questions that an analysis of the considerations that prompted him to change his views is far from easy. From the intensity of his reactions to the anti-Jewish incidents in 1898 and 1913, which I left out only because I'm running over on time, it would appear that there was a conflict with him, not simply with respect to Zionism. Within his soul, as he would have put it, there were also different responses to the Jewish question as a whole. Rationally, he had decided to abandon Jewish politics in 1872, but emotionally, he had not succeeded in eliminating strong sympathy for a cause he had thought of championing in his youth. Considering the powerful impact that his early experiences had on the development of his political outlook, this is not surprising. One of the few leaders of Russian Marxism to have truly come from the people, he always held that Marxism could be a genuinely liberating force only if it allowed the masses themselves directly to participate in the processes of political organization and agitation, and ultimately in the process of government. Axelrod's original identification had been with those masses who were also Jews, which may account for his continuing and sympathetic, though sporadic and ill-defined, interest in Jewish affairs. Although he never lost faith in Marxism, his change of mind with respect to the Jewish question implies that by 1917, Axelrod was no longer confident that the revolution would accomplish all that he had expected of it. His comments about the Paris proletariat in 1898 show that he had come to doubt that a laborer was necessarily or even potentially the embodiment of virtue. And his subsequent conflict with the Bolsheviks led him to the conclusion that even a movement that considered itself Marxist was not, by that fact alone, beyond moral reproach. In short, what I'm suggesting is that after 1882, Axelrod had become increasingly aware of the possibility that there might be some issues, particularly moral issues, that should not be resolved by reliance upon the prescriptions of a political ideology or upon political expediency. And it was in this light, as a moral issue, that he came to regard the Jewish question. It is noteworthy that in his autobiography, the published part of which ends with the year 1883, Axelrod did not mention the pogroms of 1881 or his unfinished article. He could hardly have forgotten the matter. He still had the manuscript in his personal archive, and in his memoirs he related many incidents from an earlier period that were often much less significant. Indeed, the only reference to Jews, aside from the account of his early childhood and adolescence, appears in a rather interesting context. He describes a meeting in St. Petersburg in 1880 during which the naming of a new group of revolutionaries was discussed. Axelrod objected to the name Czarny Peredziel because of its medieval connotation and because it suggested to him a break with Western European socialist movement. Socialist Federalist seemed to him both more appropriate and accurate. Several comrades objected strongly on the ground that Axelrod's title implied that after the revolution, the Russian Empire should be broken up into separate political entities, an idea that might not find favor with the people at large. Axelrod then quotes, 40 years after the event, his own reply, and I quote, "And if the people want to beat up Jews," I answered, "what if the people forcefully want to oppose Poland's separation from Russia? No, as socialists, we cannot confine our goals exclusively to suit the wishes of the people at a given moment, if those wishes are dictated by prejudice," end of quote. Whether Axelrod quoted himself correctly is far less important than the fact that this was the one reference to Jews in his autobiography written in the early 1920s. For when in 1882 he gave up his intention to speak up against the pogroms, he betrayed the very principle of not bowing to the dictates of popular prejudice. Could it be that it was too painful for Axelrod to mention the unpublished manuscript and the circumstances surrounding it, and that his insertion of the statement just quoted was his way, perhaps unconsciously, of expressing remorse for his silence in 1882 on the type of moral issue for which he now considered silence by a political leader impermissible?
Das Wort Dr. Sapir zu dem Thema Jeden rumpierte Labrovs Karriot.